All right, Isaiah chapter 5. This is going to be the one of the songs that Isaiah writes for us. We talked this morning about the importance of songs in the Bible. And so here's one of them. Isaiah is going to deliver a very powerful message to Israel in the form of a song. And he says, "Let me sing for my beloved my song concerning his vineyard." So we have to think about who's singing what. So Isaiah is singing to whom? Yes, he's singing to God. He's singing to my beloved a song concerning the beloved's vineyard. And he'll clarify who the vineyard is here in a moment. "My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He dug it, cleared it of stones, and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed out a wine vat in it. He looked for it to yield grapes." Everything sounds great, doesn't it? This guy has done all of the work necessary to have a productive vineyard, but it yielded wild grapes. Anybody ever eaten wild grapes? What do you expect from a homegrown grape? Sweet. I want sweet. You bite into that grape, you want juicy, sweet, flavorful. I'm getting almost no grapes this year, by the way. It's a weird year. The things that are producing are going crazy, but there's a lot of stuff that is just, it's like dead. I'm getting no grapes, very few apples. I don't know what's going on. But the beloved hewed out this vineyard, or built this vineyard, puts a watchtower in the midst of it. What does the watchtower do? Protect it from thieves, right. Hewed out a wine vat in it. What's the wine vat do? That's where you stop the grapes and get their yield. There were three uses for grapes in the Old Testament world. You would eat fresh grapes, but that doesn't go on very long because you know what happens to fresh grapes? They go bad. they rot if you keep them in a dark place. Now, if you put them out in the sunshine, what happens to them? They turn into raisins. And so raisin cakes were a way to preserve grapes. They would dry the grapes into raisins, and they would kind of mash them all together into a raisin cake, and that was a food source for them. But the third one was, what else do you do with grapes? You make wine out of it. So they would put it in casks, so they put it in the wine vat and stomp on it with your feet. Yes, I know, we all say, ew. We don't do that to any, well, I don't know, some places might do that. But that was how they mashed the grapes, is they would dig a gigantic bowl in the rock, and then there would be a channel leading out to a spout, where they could stomp on the grapes and the juice would flow out the channel and then they could collect it into containers. So basically what Isaiah is telling us is that God did everything necessary to make this a productive vineyard, but it only produced wild grapes. So instead of the nice, sweet, juicy grapes, it gets these little, tiny, sour ones. I love our apple trees out in the front of the church here in the springtime. Gorgeous. Beautiful trees with those blooms on them. For about a week and a half, we get absolutely beautiful flowers. But then every year it produces those tiny little apples. Do not eat one of those apples. It'll be probably the tartest thing you've ever had. Lots of pucker power. Eldon? What? Feeding the birds. Yes, yes. Feed the birds with them. So that's what God got out of his vineyard. He did everything necessary to make it productive, and yet it wasn't. It produced wild grapes. So, verse 3, "Now, inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard." What more was there for my vineyard? What more was there to do for my vineyard? What have I not done in it? And what's the expected answer? What more could God have done? Nothing. No, he did everything that was necessary. When I looked for it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? So what's the answer there? If it's not the vine dresser's fault, it must be the grapes. Right? Now, verse 5, "I'll tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I'll remove its hedge, and it shall be devoured. I'll break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. I'll make it a waste that shall not be pruned or hoed, and briars and thorns shall grow up, and I'll also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant planting. He looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed. For righteousness, but behold, an outcry. So we get to the end of the song, and now Isaiah is going to explain the comparison, which we pretty much all got anyway. The vineyard is who? Israel. Right, and the grapes are the people of Israel. God wanted it to produce grapes, but he wasn't actually talking about grapes, was he? He was talking about what? Righteousness. He took Israel, he put them in the choicest land in the world, the promised land, gave them everything necessary to be a productive people and representative of his rulership, and they didn't do it. And so now he says, I'm going to take down the walls. I'm going to take down all the protection I've given them, and I'm going to let all the nations come in and trample upon Israel. Well, how long did that go on? It's still going on, isn't it? Follow the news? The nations are still trying to trample upon Israel. So, well, I'm getting into a little more detail than Isaiah has given us yet. So, God wanted to see justice, but instead he got bloodshed. He wanted to see righteousness, but behold, an outcry, because life was so bad. Now, verse 8 and following, he's going to give us the particular, list of crimes that Israel has committed. See, June, it's fun stuff like that that makes it fun to listen when I stumble over my words like that, you know, for Sunday night stuff. So polished. I don't understand, you know, why John MacArthur hasn't called and asked me to fill in for him. Woe to those who join house to house, who add field to field until there's no more room, and you are made to dwell alone in the midst of land. The Lord of hosts has sworn in my hearing, surely many houses shall be desolate, large and beautiful houses without inhabitant. For 10 acres of vineyard shall yield but one bath, and an omer of seed shall yield but an ephah. All right. Woe to those who add house to house, add field to field. What's he talking about here? It's just someone keeps buying up all the land. What was God's intention for that land when he brought Israel to it? Every man under his own fig tree and under his own vine. Every man and family had their own plot of land that they were supposed to work and enjoy the benefits of. But Israel was getting to a place where people were extremely wealthy, some of them, and they just kept buying up more and more land. Now, under the law, you were only supposed to lease the land until the year of Jubilee, every 50 years. And then the land was supposed to revert back to the original owner, but Israel was ignoring that. They were buying the land and keeping it in perpetuity. And so God pronounces a woe upon Israel for this. It was supposed to be a place where everybody was dwelling in blessing, but Israel had come to a point where the fabulously wealthy were oppressing the poor by buying up their land, and they couldn't do anything about it. And so they're adding this field to that field. I know we don't see this going on around us either. You see these big corporations buying up all of our farmland. You know, when you drive through the country and you look and you can see where there used to be. That was a homestead. That was a homestead. That was a homestead. And now it's all big open fields, all connected together. Eldon? Yeah, it's a quarter of a square mile, right? Yeah. It's what I really appreciate about the prophets as we go through here. I think you'll find the things they condemn we're seeing going on in our own society. And so you see this idea that this is not about trying to get everybody to enjoy the blessings of the world God's given us. It's all, you know, we're going to just keep buying this up. And even corporate stuff, you know, the big corporations just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And, you know, it's sometimes seems impossible, but the Lord of hosts, verse 9, has sworn in my hearing, surely many houses shall be desolate, large and beautiful houses without inhabitants. So you keep buying up land, bringing all the money for yourself. You're building yourself these huge palaces at the expense of the poor. And God says, yeah, that's not going to last. Now, I want to take you back to our timeline here. Isaiah begins his ministry sometime right here. Can you guys see that, or is that not very big? I'll zoom in one more time. There we go. So Isaiah begins his ministry right here. He tells us that it's during the reign of Uzziah, which is the king back this direction, Jotham, Ahaz, and a little bit later on, Hezekiah, that Isaiah has his ministry. So starting sometime around 765 BC, somewhere around there, is when Isaiah begins his ministry. When does God kick Israel out of the land? Anybody know the date? What's that? No, it's even later than that. 586 BC. All right. Almost 200 years later that God finally fulfills this promise, desolations in the houses. And so he's telling the people about this way, way ahead of time. And he's going to give us a little bit of an inkling here of what's going on. 10 acres of a vineyard shall yield but one bath. Okay, so I'm not much of a farmer when it comes to vineyards. I know a little bit about corn and soybean and what they should yield, but corn didn't exist back then. And soybean was still growing out in the jungles of China, I think. We hadn't really discovered it. As far as a major crop like that. But they were growing lots of vines. But 10 acres of vine, of grapevine, and it's yielding over only one bath, which was about 6 gallons. Now, I have one grapevine out there growing on my chicken coop. And last year, we pressed 6 gallons of grapes out of that one vine. 6 gallons of juice, I think, out of that one vine. Not bad. Right, so imagine 10 acres of grapevines, and all you get is 6 gallons. That is really bad yield. Would that be something like getting 10 bushels per acre, Eldon, of corn?
Out of
10 acres? Wow. Eldon. Oh, okay. Oh, wow. Really? At what point, this is just idle curiosity, but at what point do you say that's not even worth harvesting?
Well, it wasn't, but the only thing on this is...
You can't leave it standing? Okay, so you got to combine it just to break it up. Okay. Okay. So 10 acres should give us 168,000 bottles of wine. And I'm guessing a bath of wine might be something like 20 or 30 bottles. All right, 6 gallons. So I don't know how much wine goes into a bottle. So, obviously, what God's telling is it doesn't matter how much land you've amassed to yourself. I'm going to command that you get no benefit from it. Because who commands the blessing to grow out of the ground? God does. God commands the skies to yield their fruit to us. We have very little control over that. We think we do. We keep coming up with these new hybrids of plants that produce more per acre, But God is the one who gives the blessing. God is the one that commands the earth to yield to us. So if you take a garden, or if you raise a garden every year, just remember to give God the praise when you pull those plants out. God created those little plants, little factories to convert sunlight, water, and dirt into something delicious. And that's his goodness to us. Woe to those, verse 11, woe to those who rise early in the morning that they may run after strong drink, who tarry late into the evening as wine inflames them. They have lyre and harp, tambourine and flute, and wine at their feasts, but they do not regard the deeds of the Lord or see the work of his hand. Therefore, my people go into exile for lack of knowledge. Their honored men go hungry. Their multitude is parched with thirst. Therefore, Sheol has enlarged its appetite and opened its mouth beyond measure, and the nobility of Jerusalem and her multitude will go down, her revelers and he who exults in her. Man is humbled, and each one is brought low, and the eyes of the haughty are brought low. But the Lord of hosts is exalted in justice, and the holy God shows himself holy in righteousness. So I'll back up there to that pronouncement of woe once again. So what is God condemning them for now? Yeah, they're just living the party life. They've amassed all this wealth, so they don't need to go out and work. So what do they fill their time up with? They get up and they party. They get up and they drink. They get drunk. They don't regard the deeds of the Lord or see the work of his hands. You know, having wealth does not mean that you need to forget what the Lord has done for you or be thankful for it or use your substance for his glory. If he gives you wealth, that's what he wants you to do with it. But these people, because they had gotten wealthy, had forgotten their dependence upon the Lord. Verse 13, he says, therefore, because they're doing these things, my people go into exile for lack of knowledge. Not for lack of scientific knowledge, by the way, but lack of spiritual knowledge. They refuse to acknowledge God, to give him thanks for his blessings, to seek his blessings, and so therefore they're going into exile. This is one of the first pronouncements that the punishment coming upon Israel is going to be exile. He's going to kick them out of the land. Now, he told them that back in the book of Deuteronomy, that if they were disobedient, he would use the other nations to punish Israel. But now he's bringing this point up to remind his people, yeah, this is what's going to happen. You guys have been disobedient to my covenant, and so I'm going to boot you out of my land. You're not going to get to enjoy it anymore. Everybody's going to go hungry. The honored men are going to go hungry. Their multitude will be parched with thirst. So you thought your wealth was protecting you. How fast can somebody lose $50 billion? Can happen fast, can it? I mean, we look at that staggering number and think, that's insanity. How does somebody have that much money? And I'm not saying it's wrong to be rich. But you say, wow, that's a lot of money. But how fast can it be lost? Eldon?
In 1929, when the stock market collapsed, and nobody knew what was going on, there was some of the unions had, the railroads had all their retirement funds in the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
And they lost all the railroad workers in one day.
Mm. That's a hard loss. Well, that's what God is prescribing for his people here. That kind of dramatic, fast destruction of wealth. And a lot of times it's because the wealth didn't really exist. You know, look at the numbers of wealth that our people report today, and most of it's just on paper. That wealth doesn't really exist anywhere. So it's a very strange thing to try to trace it. But even having lots of land can be erased pretty quickly, especially if your country's overrun by an invader. Then what good is having all that land? It doesn't benefit you anything. So verse 14, he tells us, therefore, Sheol has enlarged its appetite. What is Sheol? The grave, death. So death is marching through the land of Israel in this section. It's enlarged its appetite. It's opened its mouth beyond measure. and the nobility of Jerusalem, and her multitude will go down, her revelers and he who exalts in her. So God is pronouncing a very great judgment upon Israel because of her luxurious living. Verse 15, this is going to repeat the theme that we saw a couple chapters ago that said the Lord God of hosts has a day against all that is exalted and lifted up. God is going to humble every proud thing that man tries to exalt. Everything that man tries to bring, lift himself up with and trust in other than God, God's going to destroy it. So verse 15, man is humbled, each one is brought low, and the eyes of the haughty are brought low. But the Lord of hosts is exalted in justice, and the holy God shows himself holy in righteousness. Now, there's a lot of injustice even in our world. There always has been, there always will be. By the way, this political rancor that everybody's upset about and saying we need to get back to calm politics, it never existed. When was politics ever calm? Maybe there were times when it wasn't quite as agitated as it is now, but read the history of the world and you'll find out politics has almost always been a very cantankerous issue, because you're talking about which worldview rules the country, and that's important. Which view of this world rules things and dictates our laws and how we're going to operate? So, don't let people convince you that if you have a political opinion that that means you're somehow small-minded or that you're somehow a cantankerous person, an ornery. You know, have convictions. Speak them kindly, but have them. That's a little bit of a side thing. That's for free. All right. Verse 17, okay, so verse 16 talks about the justice of God and the righteousness of God. Verse 17, then shall the lambs graze as in their pastures, and nomads shall eat among the ruins of the rich. So, God's going to break up all these monopolies. The people that have been amassing all this land for themselves and for their own pleasure, God's going to destroy it. All their wealth is going to be gone. Their conglomerates are going to be broken up. And he says, you know what? I'm just going to let the sheep graze there, because that's what I meant it for anyway. And nomads shall eat among the ruins of the rich. And God's going to just bring everything back low again. Verse 18, he goes into another statement of woe. So that word woe sort of starts us into a whole new section, where he's going to bring out a list of grievances against the people. So we saw the grievance of they're just living the party life. The first grievance was they're just amassing all this land. The second one was they're living these party lives. So the third one here, woe to those who draw iniquity with cords of falsehood, who draw sin as with cart ropes. What is the picture being presented there? Yeah, you carry around a lot of it. What do you do with a cart rope? Pull a cart. And what is apparently loading this cart down? Sin and iniquity, yeah. So the idea is they're hauling this stuff around like it's their goods. That's what they're selling. Iniquity, falsehood. And they're pulling it around with him, trying to dispense it everywhere else. Verse 19, they also say, let him be quick, let him speed his work that we may see it. Let the counsel of the Holy One of Israel draw near, and let it come that we may know it. Are these people wanting the knowledge of God, or is there something else going on there?
Are they mocking him?
They're mocking him. They're daring him. You talk about God being righteous. Yeah, let's see him be righteous. I know we don't get any of that in our day either. He continues on, woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. You see the flip-flopping that's going on? This is what happened when sin comes to maturity in any society. Right gets defined as wrong. Wrong gets defined as right. So in our world's eyes, what is the most noble thing that you can be now? What's that? Yeah. Oh, the trans people, they're just so brave. They've done so many, they've endured so many, this is what the world's saying, by the way. Okay, this is not what I'm saying. Our world, our society holds them up. Oh, you're so brave. You've endured so much hardship. We need to favor you in everything. And what happens if you say, that's not right. God says that's wrong. Now what are you called? You're a hater. You see the flipping that's happened? Telling the truth has become hateful. Speaking what is right and what is true has become intolerant. The most noble thing our society says you can be is tolerant of everybody except those who tell the truth. You have to hate them. Cancel them. Push them out of society. We don't want them. They don't reflect our society's values. Pay attention, by the way, to how often that kind of phrasing gets used when you hear somebody actually speaking the truth. They'll say, we need to push them out because that does not reflect our society's values. That's what they were saying about Chick-fil-A a few years back. You know, when Chick-fil-A was having a bunch of negative press because the owner of Chick-fil-A stood for biblical marriage. And there were cities trying to put all of the Chick-fil-A's out of business and say, oh yeah, Chick-fil-A, that doesn't represent our city's values. Really, what are your city's values? Oh, we believe in tolerance. We hate people who are intolerant. Now, this total illogical reversal. And by the way, folks, try to let people know this too. Don't sit there trying to figure out what's the logical connection here. It doesn't. It doesn't have one. It doesn't make sense. If it is a lie, then by definition, it can't be coherent. Their whole worldview doesn't all fit together. It will be contradictory. And they are fighting each other, by the way. Now, going on to this idea of homosexuality and transgenderism that we brought up here a little bit, but have you noticed that the traditional homosexual people are at war with the transgender people? And you know why? Because what was the call of the homosexual movement? It's either genetic or you're born that way. They were desperately looking for something that said, it's not my fault, I just the way I am. And then along came the transgender movement, which is the next wave of homosexuality. And their call is, it's all about how I feel. It's just whatever I identify as. This is what I want to be. So today, if I want to be this, I can be this. Tomorrow, I can be this. Well, that's not how you were born then. That's whatever you're choosing to be now. And so those two sides are actually at war with each other because they realized an inherent contradiction in how they're framing these things. But there's a reversal of what's good and what's evil. So we go out there, we proclaim what God says is good, and they say, scream at us, yell at us, hate us, kick us out of their society and say, we're the most evil people that have ever existed. They put darkness for light, light for darkness. They put bitter for sweet, and sweet for bitter. Verse 21, woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and shrewd in their own sight. In whose eyes are we supposed to be wise? God's eyes. Because God defines the truth. And it's not that he arbitrarily sits up there and says, well, I want this to be right and that to be wrong. His character and his nature define what's true. Giving is good because God is giving. Patience is good because God is patient. He defines what's good and what's bad, what's right and what's wrong. We don't get to do that. And hencely, by the way, that whole argument for transgenderism is who gets to define what reality is. You know, the reason they get so angry at us is because we are attacking the core of their argument. You do not get to define reality for yourself. God does that. The sky is blue. And they can shout all day long that the sky is red, and they can try to demand of us that we say the sky is red, but we have to look up and say, but the sky's blue. There are how many genders? Two. Because in the beginning, God created them male and female. In the image of God created he them, male and female, he created them. We don't get to decide other than that. I don't get to make up my own. Just like I can't walk out and say, the sky is red. It isn't red. It might be getting orange here now the sunset's coming. The sky is blue. Don't be wise in your own sight. Let God tell you what's right and wrong. Orient your thinking based on what He says is true and what's not true. And then it doesn't matter what all the rest of the world is doing. You choose to do it the way God says to. Verse 22, woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine and valiant men and mixing strong drink. Now there again is that party mentality, right? Hey, how much can we drink? How much drugs can we do? Real men drop the beers down, right? No, real men are controlled. Real men have self-control. Real men don't succumb to peer pressure to do what everybody else is doing. They do what they know is right even when everybody else isn't doing it. All right, they acquit the guilty for a bribe. They deprive the innocent of his right. I know, we never see this happen these days where the rich people can get out of being punished for a crime. But poor people are overly punished. Yeah. Therefore, as the tongue of fire devours the stubble and as dry grass sinks down in the flames, so their root will be as rottenness and their blossom will go up like dust. For they have rejected the law of the Lord of hosts and have despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. Therefore, the anger of the Lord was kindled against his people, and he stretched out his hand and struck them, and the mountains quaked, and their corpses were as refuse in the midst of the streets. For all of this, his anger has not turned away, and his hand is stretched out still. So God's bringing this punishment. He's going to send Israel into exile. He's going to destroy many of the people. He's going to wipe out all of the wealth. And is that going to satisfy his anger against their sin? How much would God have to destroy us before his anger would be assuaged? Completely? And even then, if God would just like, poof, we're all out of existence, we've all been annihilated, would that deal with our sin? Yeah. Even suffering in hell for an eternity will not atone for sin. The wrath of God will not be placated. And so they will stay there forever. What did it take to satisfy the wrath of God? Christ died for our sin. Christ died for the sins of Israel. They are his chosen nation, and no, that doesn't mean that every single Israelite is a believer and has their sins forgiven. God has a special purpose for that group of people, and he's going to accomplish it. And any of them that are saved will be saved because Christ died for them. So that phrase right there actually is going to come up several times in the book of Isaiah. We're going to see that as a refrain. For all this, his anger is not turned away, and his hand is stretched out still. Okay, we got, oh my goodness. Yeah, all right, we'll pick up there next time. Okay, at this rate, it will probably take us another 5 years to get through Isaiah. Okay.
66 chapters.
It is a long book. It is, yeah. Especially when they really are just so full. And you go through these things, and the stuff that God is saying is so profound to us and so meaningful.